Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary together to order. Excuse me. We're all together to talk about five different bills today. And we have two representatives that are here. And I could be going on, let's go on beauty first. So we'll go with House Bill 2334A.
I was like, Representative Hicks tried to stand up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2334A clarifies the mental state of promoting prostitution as knowingly in ORS 167.012, and it adds attempt into covered conduct in ORS 167.017, modifying the prostitution rather than the compelling.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing us to come in. Thank you for letting us be first. I really appreciate it. Chair Prozanski and members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei representing House District 41. As you already know, sex trafficking of minors is an important and a continuing problem. Last session, the legislature worked hard on this issue. We increased the penalties for those who buy sex from children, and we made it easier for prosecutors to go after the traffickers of children. The bill that I bring you today, House Bill 2334A, closes a loophole in the compelling prostitution law. Currently, when a pimp puts a girl in the street, if the girl calls the police for help before committing the act of prostitution, the criminal cannot be charged with compelling prostitution, but only a lesser charge. The perpetrator can be out on the street in a matter of days, putting the victim again at risk. This bill changes the definition to include compelling attempted prostitution to the charge. Multnomah County Prosecutor J.R. Ujafusa is here to tell you more about the specifics of this bill, and I want to thank the chair and members of this committee for all the work that you've done on child sex trafficking, and as we know, it is a daunting task.
Good morning, J.R.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is J.R. Ujafusa. I'm a deputy district attorney for Multnomah County, and I'm assigned to prosecute compelling and promoting charges as well as federal sex trafficking charges. What I'd like to state about adding this attempt language into the bill is it does exactly what the representative said, but it also helps when we are prosecuting a full compelling, meaning that it's not an attempt activity, when a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old minor gets up on the stand. A prosecutor does not have to go through, and we do not have to prove each sex act. That by showing the intent of the offender, the defendant, by showing he took substantial steps, it makes it so that those children, one, do not have to remember the specific dates, times, and locations of each sex act that they were forced to do, but also gives prosecutors the tools and the ability to show that the intent of the trafficker was to induce or compel them or aid and facilitate a minor. In my experience, there have been cases, although the majority would be what I spoke to earlier, which is helping prosecutors prosecute these traffickers. There are cases in which a trafficker uses violence, force, intimidation towards a adult or a minor, but because that minor or adult does the right thing and calls police, that defendant is benefits from them calling police, meaning that they can only be charged with an attempt compelling. This would not make it so, because for those defendants or suspects who are doing this, they've done everything they can in order to force an adult or minor to engage in prostitution, and we should not be rewarding them when the victims come forward and do the right thing and call police.
All right, thank you. Questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. JR, I think we had testimony earlier in the year. How many of these cases have been prosecuted in the last year or so? And I believe they said there had been none. Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you have any statistics at all?
Chair Prozanski, Representative Close, there have been cases that have been prosecuted. I guess I want to clarify exactly what your question is. Are you talking about attempt?
No, I was talking about the $10,000 fine legislation that was previously.
I think we need to put this in context. We're talking about patronizing prostitution is what you had testified before. What we have before us now, Senator Close, is dealing with compelling prostitution, which is a different statute.
Correct.
And probably has different outcomes based on what the his office has been able to do.
Right. And I guess I'll speak to both things. This is regarding the trafficker or the pimp.
Right.
So this is those individuals who aid and facilitate a minor or use compel by using force or intimidation for a minor and adult. This House Bill 2334A gets at those individuals. I believe your question was based on the buyers. Is that what you're asking me?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to go ahead and rule that out of order for what we have here today. We're here to talk about the compelling prostitution.
Could I have a follow-up?
No, not right now. I have a point I want to make, so hang on a second. So, J.R., could you just for the record, based on having the change in the compelling prostitution, adding the attempt, what we're going to actually be able to do is maintain the same level of offense so it wouldn't be dropped down one level? Could you please explain how that would work?
Sure. That's exactly right. With an attempt, it actually drops it down two levels in the sentencing guidelines. And what it makes is most individuals are eligible for probation rather than prison. And so what Representative Tomei said is exactly right, that those individuals would be out on the street quickly after they were picked up. But more importantly, I think it adds some tools for prosecutors to get at cases where we know prostitution acts have happened, but proving them can be more difficult than proving that the pimp or the trafficker intended and took substantial steps to get them involved in prostitution.
All right, Senator Close?
No, thank you.
Any other questions? Well, that you don't get to ask questions.
No.
All right, any other comments regarding for this panel? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2334A? Gail, please come forward. Thank you all for coming forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Posnanski, for the indulgence. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is consensus amendment with OCDLA, and we do appreciate Representative Tomei's willingness and also the ODAA's willingness to come to that agreement. I just want to make clear that the reason that this can have the attempt language modifying the victim's behavior is that the defendant's behavior of compelling remains the same. They're aiding and abetting a minor to engage in prostitution, or they're using force or coercion or causing another, compelling another to engage in prostitution. The defendant's conduct stays the same. What is now being changed is once that person, the victim, gets out into the street and starts to prostitute, if they choose to make a phone call, that still includes compelling because the defendant has done everything that he needs to have done to have effectuated that course of conduct. So.
All right, thank you. Any questions or comments? Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2334A. We have everything. Open up a work session on House Bill 2334A. Senator Dingfelter.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2334A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelter moves House Bill 2334A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry House Bill 2334A to the floor. As we can see, Senator Roebling is not here this morning. I believe he had some other duties he needed to take care of, so he'll be excused from votes today until he returns. We'll go ahead and close the work session on 2334A. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2962A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2962A changes the current standard applied by the courts in speedy trial law. Defendant will bear the burden of proof in showing that the delay in trial caused excessive pretrial incarceration, impairment to the defense, or humiliation and indignity suffered by the defendant as a result of the delay. It would declare an emergency and effective upon passage.
All right. And Representative Hicks is here. Wally, who would you like to bring up with you, if anybody?
Mr. Knott, please.
Yes.
Okay. Paul, Aaron, and Representative. When you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Wally Hicks, House District 3, Josephine County. House Bill 2962 is a repeal in its present form of the Speedy Trial Statute. The Speedy Trial Statute was put in place in 1959 as an endeavor to be a housekeeping measure for the courts, to allow the courts to dismiss cases that had gotten stale or simply not progressing. And it was used for many years to productive effect. Lately, however, due to a variety of factors, resources, pressures on the trial courts and the like, the Speedy Trial Statute has lost its utility, its original intended utility, and has become essentially a basis for appeal that doesn't achieve what it was originally designed to do. And so the House did vote to repeal the statute. The original measure as proposed was an attempt to codify the Speedy Trial Statute, and so within OLIS, if the committee wanted to see what the original attempt at codification was, then it'll be the non-engrossed version of the bill. It'll just be the original version that was submitted of 2962. So ultimately, the decision was made to amend the bill and make it a repeal of the statute, and that would leave in place not the statute, but all of the constitutional provisions and protections that have come into being. Over the course of many decades that protect a defendant's right to a speedy trial. And so another way of saying that is that while the Speedy Trial Statute would be repealed under this bill, the right to a speedy trial would remain as in effect as it always has been. So there's a difference there that is not to be confused. This bill does not repeal a defendant's right to a speedy trial, as that would be impossible. It's a constitutional guarantee. However, the bill would repeal a statute that has arguably outlived its usefulness, and that unless, I suppose, the state is willing and able to devote sufficient resources to our judicial system to get us back to a point where we can have a speedy trial statute, then the statute is most appropriately repealed.
All right, thank you. Who would like to go next?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 2962. To touch briefly on what the representative just explained, there are two sort of species of speedy trial. There's constitutional and statutory, and constitutional we can't touch. Because it is a constitutional creature, it doesn't appear in the statutes. It only appears in the case law. And the constitutional speedy trial requires a defendant to show that they suffered prejudice, meaning the delay in bringing them to trial caused something bad to happen to them. The phraseology used is sort of undue humiliation, or like an example would be if a witness died, became unavailable, evidence was destroyed, all of this is the result of the passage of time, that would mean prejudice. Something bad happened to the defendant. The statutory speedy trial mechanism, on the other hand, doesn't ask whether the defendant was prejudiced in any way. It just looks at a delay. And sometimes this delay can be 12 or 13 months. Now, if that delay occurs, it leads to the dismissal of the case without prejudice, meaning that the case can immediately be refiled. So I'll walk you through how that can actually play out very briefly. So a warrant goes into the system for a defendant's arrest. Because of resource limitations in that county, maybe there are only 3-4 badges on the street for a county 100 miles across who can actually serve the warrant. So it takes 13-14 months to serve the warrant. At that time, the defendant is arrested. The defendant is given a defense attorney if they need one, if they're indigent. They're given trial dates, and much of the expense borne by the state of bringing that defendant to trial is spent at that time. Their attorney files a motion to dismiss on speedy trial grounds, statutory speedy trial grounds, and the case is dismissed. At that point, the state re-indicts the case, and a warrant goes back into the system, and the whole cycle starts all over again. And the Department of Justice, this is not a Department of Justice bill. We came in support of this bill for a few reasons. Number one, we feel it's very unfair to victims because they come in, they testify at grand jury, the indictment is issued, the warrant goes into the system, their life goes on hold. Often more so than the defendant. While they wait for the defendant to be located and arrested to finally have trial dates, they get to the moment of trial and the case is dismissed and the process starts all over again. This can go on until this into the statute statute of limitations with no resolution for the victim. Also, our appellate division, as you see in our submitted materials, spends, we estimate, between 276 and 460 hours a year resolving this on the appellate level. And finally, what we're hearing from across the state is that in small counties, and I believe that DA Dinah Vitalens will come up and tell you about her experience in Crook County, but this is playing out over and over again. What I want to emphasize is that these are, by definition, prosecutable cases, because if not, the state is unable to proceed, and it's resolved in another way. And number two, cases where there is no prejudice to the defendant, because if there is prejudice, if a defense attorney can argue successfully that their client in some way was damaged by the delay, then they can have the case dismissed on constitutional rather than statutory speedy trial grounds. At that point, the state can't reindict. So any defense attorney with the option to get a dismissal for prejudice will always take it. So these are dismissals of prosecutable cases that are being dismissed only because it took 13 months to serve a warrant. So the Department of Justice feels that this is a statute that has outlived its usefulness and is having a real unintended but severe deleterious effect on small counties without finding any prejudice for the defendant at all. This is essentially a housekeeping mechanism that has started to run amok. So I'll turn it over to Paul Smith, who's an assistant attorney general and more familiar with the legal history of statutory versus constitutional speedy trial. Then I'll be open for questions as well.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Paul Smith, I'm the attorney in charge of criminal and collateral remedies appeals in the appellate division of the Department of Justice, to testify in support of House Bill 2962. As both the representative and Mr. Knott indicated, this bill does not eliminate any rights for a defendant. The Constitution, both the United States and the state constitution, guarantee defendants' rights to a speedy trial. All this bill does is eliminate what is a house cleaning mechanism. That's what the Supreme Court of Oregon has described ORS 135-747 as, is a housekeeping mechanism designed to allow courts to move cases out that are languishing in the system. As Mr. Knott described, most often the reason these cases are languishing in the system has to do with judicial and law enforcement resources in order to serve warrants on people, on defendants who have failed to appear for one reason or another. I also want to talk for just a moment about the costs of litigating this from an appellate perspective. I have briefed probably 24 statutory speedy trial cases in my time with the appellate division, and over the last about 15 months, the appellate division has briefed all told about 24 or 25 of these cases. The Oregon Court of Appeals has written, I believe, over a dozen opinions in the last 2 years on statutory speedy trial. These are fact-intensive, resource-intensive cases to brief, because the statutory speedy trial test involves looking at the length of delay. That's often fairly easy to determine, but not always, because you're looking at who caused the delay and what the reasons for the delay were. This is fact-intensive to litigate in the trial courts. It's fact-intensive to brief in the appellate courts. And then, so that's a cost that's borne by both the trial-level prosecutor and the defense attorney, and the state and the defense attorneys on appeal. That's also a cost that's borne by the appellate courts when they have to evaluate each of these cases. As Mr. Knott indicated, we spend somewhere between 276 and 460 hours per year just devoted to this. Will some of that time be shifted over to constitutional litigation? Maybe a small amount will, but the reason constitutional litigation right now does not take near the resources is because in order for a defendant to achieve a dismissal of a case on constitutional speedy trial grounds, that defendant has to prove that he or she was prejudiced by the delay. That can include excessive pretrial incarceration, but most often what it includes is a defendant being able to say, a witness who would have been favorable to my case is no longer available to the case. And if the defendant can establish that that witness would in fact have been favorable, the defendant can get dismissal on constitutional grounds. Sometimes the delay for a constitutional speedy trial violation is longer than what we see as typical delay for a statutory speedy trial violation, but it doesn't have to be. There could be delay of less than a year, and if defendant can establish that he or she was prejudiced by that delay and wasn't the fault of that delay, he or she could get a dismissal under the Constitution. So I would just emphasize, this bill does not take away any rights of a defendant. A defendant does not have a right to have his or her case swept out of the system because the system, because it's been languishing in the system. A defendant has a right to have his or her case dismissed because his or her constitutional right to a speedy trial has been violated. I'm available for any questions if the committee has them.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd just say that Mr. Knott was talking about the lack of badges, and in our part of the state, Representative Hicks, there is a lack of badges, and anybody who's been to Southern Oregon knows there's lots of places to hide. So I think there's some relevancy in this.
Senator Dinkfelder?
Well, I guess I had a question about, on the other end, how, and it's somewhat related to what Senator Cruz just said, is my concern about this, what I'm hearing is that on one side we're saying we don't have the resources, so, you know, this is an unrealistic expectation, and I'm a little concerned about that, and I did notice that there was a lot of no votes over on the other side, and I was curious about why that was. I don't know if you want to speak to that, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dinkfelder, that's right. I'm nobody's spokesperson but my own, but certainly I think that was the issue. Is this what we've come to? That we've got such an ill-resourced justice system that we can't even afford statutory... I mean, this is me talking now, but we can't... We are choosing not to afford a statutory speedy trial.
Right.
That's
so,
the way I see it.
Mr. Chair, I do have some concerns about that. I understand the situation, especially some counties are in, but the flip side is we could say that for a lot of issues. And so that's a concern that I have, and I understand what you're saying that about constitutionality, but I know for instance, you know, for my county, I mean, not to say that we aren't challenged for resources, but I want to make sure we do have speedy trials for folks. It's an important part of our justice system, and to say that, you know, we can't afford to do this, I'm not sure is the right message we want to send, but anyway, I'll stop there.
Okay. So I'd like to put a couple of things on the record, because when we're looking at the statutory speedy trial versus constitutional speedy trial, for whatever reason, back in 1959, the legislature enacted it. I'm not sure what the history was, if this was something that the courts brought forward as a means to manage their dockets, or why it actually came into existence. It is interesting that it does not have a prejudice requirement as the Constitution does. Be very frank with you, I've talked to individuals on both sides of the issue, and I would like to get more information before we move forward. It seems to me that when you have something that's been in place for 40 years, and now we're seeing or hearing that one of the reasons for maybe abolishing it is because of lack of resources, it's one of those things I think we as a legislature need to take a little time to figure out. Are we reacting to an economic situation as compared to whatever was the basis for having the statutory equivalence of a Speedy Trial Act in place? So I think it's something that I would like to get a little bit more information. We do have a couple of the people who are wanting to testify, so I'd like to get them on the record, then we can figure out what we're doing. I did speak with Representative Hicks yesterday, telling him that at this point I was leaning toward having this going into interim work. Since this has been on the books since 1959, I don't see by putting it off until February, if that's what it takes, for us to be able to actually ensure that we're doing what the legislature should be doing based on the facts that are given to us today and what the reasons were for actually having enacted the statute back in 1959. So questions, comments to that before we bring up the next panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so what I'm going to do is, Dinah, why don't you go ahead and come on up? I'm going to go ahead and ask Becky Strauss and Gail Meyer to come up, since we only have three more people to give testimony. And Representative Dimbro, we are, didn't forget you, but we didn't actually see you in the back. And then when we looked at the sign-up sheet, there was no one signed up. So we've put your name down as well as Amy Joyce's. So we'll have you up after this one. Dinah, why don't you go first?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vitalens. I'm the Crook County District Attorney and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. In Crook County, we have one jury courtroom. We litigate these cases on a motion to dismiss on the statutory speedy trial grounds at least once a month. And what it requires, the hearings are usually 2 to 3 hours, and it requires a court clerk to testify about everything that's happened in the case. And the defendant does nothing other than sit there. And so because we only have one jury courtroom, cases are regularly continued because of lack of judicial resources. By way of example, I had a recent case where it was a horrible animal neglect case. The trial court suppressed evidence. We appealed that, and the Court of Appeals reversed. Right after it came back from the Court of Appeals, the defense attorney filed a motion to dismiss based on statutory speedy grounds, and I spent 3 hours in a hearing with Senior Assistant Attorney General Paul Smith testifying, and the state had asked for one continuance, and that was at the appellate level. My office never asked for a continuance, but it was court setovers and the defense attorney requests, yet we had to spend 3 hours litigating that, excuse me, and so it's a horrible waste of resources that my staff, we have these hearings once a month, and it's all due to the fact that we have one jury courtroom in Crook County. And so I urge you to pass 2962A.
All right, before we take the testimony from the other two, since you're favoring and they're opposing, Dinah, do you think we would have a different outcome in the sense of the defense attorney would not have filed the same motion on the constitutional basis if that was the only recourse they had attempting to show prejudice based on the delay?
Chair Przanski, I don't believe that. When I speak with defense attorneys about why they file these motions, they're worried about post-conviction if they don't. And they do know that their clients have no prejudice. I mean, the case is, it's not in the prosecutor's interest to let these cases languish either. I mean, witnesses, we lose witnesses. Witnesses forget about you know, details that happen. And so we push, my office policy is that we don't ask for any continuances unless we have a critical witness who's missing, because we don't want to lose these motions because the victim's affected.
All right. So just following up, so I'm just trying to make sure I understand the issue. It's your understanding that the defense is only seeking the statutory remedy and would not be going after the constitutional remedy if they were, in fact, limited to the constitutional remedy only. You don't think that they would be filing these based on prejudice of delay?
Chair Przanski, in the last 12 motions that we've argued, only one defendant has asserted a constitutional right that they were prejudiced, and that's in the last 12 motions that we've seen in Crook County.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Any other questions for her? Becky, Gail, whoever would like to lead off.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here in opposition to the bill and just want to provide a very brief overview and let Gail take the practitioner perspective. But we do have concerns about this bill. As has been stated, there is a more protective statutory speedy trial scheme here in Oregon now than more protective than the Oregon or federal constitutional speedy trial right. And we've had that for a very long time here in Oregon. So our concern is that the problems of inadequate resources in the court system and the public safety system are very immediate. They're very real. Our concern here is that we're balancing those on the backs of the criminal defendants, eroding statutory rights that exist right now for sort of a non-policy purpose. And so we are pleased to see the inclination to move toward a work group and discuss this a little bit further. So thank you.
Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'll be brief. I'd like to thank the chair for coming down to the conclusion that this requires greater study, because we think it does. We think it looks different county to county. There's some counties where we understand essentially they take a great case to grand jury and get a warrant, and the defendant doesn't know that there's a warrant out there. And if the defendant is not apprehended for 18 months until a left-hand turn, it is difficult sometimes for the defendant to establish prejudice. So if there's a bar fight outside of a bar in a parking lot, and there's people in cars who see it, if this were an immediate arrest, an immediate enaction of a case, the defense could possibly go back and recreate who was in that parking lot. 18 months later, you can't really recreate that. So you don't really know who the witnesses are, so there's an inability to really prove prejudice. The standard that is set in this statute, people have suggested it's been codified since 1959. If you read the Oregon case law, they trace it back all the way to a calendar system calculation that's been in effect since we were a territory. And we can't help but think that there is utility in having that standard at the trial court level. We're glad to hear that this is going to be subjected to greater study, because we have not heard from the Judicial Department on this one. This impacts judicial administration greatly, both at the trial court level and at the appellate level. I'd like to see the data, really see how this looks.
All right. Questions?
If I could just comment. I understand your point, Gail, but by the same token, a warrant could be issued and the defendant couldn't know about it and just evade detection for a long time, and so he could potentially benefit by the statute just for being elusive.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, I'm glad you brought that up, because actually the case law is pretty clear that that part is exempted out of the calculation. So the current statute, the statutory speedy trial that we're talking about here, is basically a calendar-based analysis of how long of a time has happened and who's responsible for the length of time. Anytime the defendant has requested continuances or has brought motions that has delayed things down, or has failed to appear, absconded, that is not calculated against the state. That's calculated against the defendant. So you exempt all that. And then the other question in calculation becomes is, what's the balance of the time, and what part of it is reasonable, and what part is not? There is allowance under some of the case law to take a look at limitations of judicial resources. So if everybody's in the chair, and they keep showing up, and the case keeps getting continued and continued and continued, the court on appeal has said that limited judicial resources can be a justifiable, reasonable basis for a length of time to trial. But the defendant cannot just abscond and get the benefit of this. That part of is pulled out of the calculus of whether or not there's been a reasonable delay or not.
Follow up?
Yes.
Okay. I guess I'm slightly confused here. I'm looking at the statutory provision here, and because it's not based on prejudice, it's just based on the clock.
Correct.
And what you're talking about, I would assume any appeal prejudice could be established. I guess I'm just wondering why we have a statute that is just based on the clock and not compelling reasons.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, it's curious to see that this really does go back to the territory, because before we were territory, basically it said if the defendant's indicted and the trial has not been postponed upon his application or with his consent, then it must be brought to trial at least within the next term of the court, or the court may then the court must order dismissal unless good cause to the contrary is shown. So basically it was a calendar system. If you're not brought to trial in this term of court, you got to be brought to trial in the next term of court unless the defendant has made a reason why it cannot be. So that followed through the DD code when it was first enacted after statehood and then on up through. And it shows up now in the current codification. It's a calendar-based analysis. It is devoid from an analysis of prejudice. It was subsequent to this territorial law and then the enactment in the DD code that the constitutional analysis came down, both from the federal side and the state side, that introduced the notion of no harm, no foul. If the defendant hasn't been prejudiced in their case and can't establish prejudice, then we're not going to say there's a constitutional violation. And my point being is that it is difficult sometimes with mere delay for the defense to really prove they've been prejudiced, because it's difficult to recreate lost witnesses whom you cannot interview. And so it's one thing if you know you had a witness and that witness died. It's another thing to say, there were witnesses, but I don't know who they are, and I can't find them anymore because nobody told me I was under an indictment. That's the other issue.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2962A, and we're going to go ahead and open up let me just say this for the record. What I'm going to do on that bill is, I said, I think we need a little bit more time. I'm going to have Mr. Smith set this for a work session on May 28th at this point. The reason for that is we're going to see if we can get some answers to the questions that have been raised. I know that there's some of my colleagues that would like to have the bill move faster than what it's scheduled for right now. Does not mean that we're going to get there, but I think it would be important to have the judicial branch weigh in as to their perspective and where they're at, and then we can figure out if we need to take this all the way into the interim or not. So with that, we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2986A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2986A directs Department of Transportation and Department of Corrections to work with Judicial Department to assist formerly incarcerated individuals in apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs with reinstatement of driver's licenses suspended for non-payment of fines.
All right, thank you. Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Chair Pazanski. I'm Michael Dembrough. I represent House District 45. That's Northeast Portland out to Park Rose, with the lovely little city within a city of Maywood Park in between. And it's a pleasure to bring what I hope you will find an attractive little bill. I know that you took the representative bills in the order from most attractive to least attractive representative, but I hope you won't find that's true of the bill.
We're beard friendly here.
House Bill 2986 provides a way for ex-offenders to break out of a vicious circle and become productive citizens in our communities after they've served their time. For many ex-offenders, the best route back into society is through a pre-apprenticeship or apprenticeship program. These programs get them the skills they need and put them on track to employment. Last year, I had a meeting with the Oregon Tradeswomen's Association, which is a great organization trying to get more women into the trades, and heard about a program that they have at Coffee Creek Penitentiary, getting women inmates who are preparing for release to move into training in the trades. And I learned there of a serious problem that many of them face, something I had no idea about. Many ex-offenders are blocked from being part of an apprenticeship program because to be enrolled in a pre-apprenticeship or an apprenticeship program, they've got to have a valid driver's license. They have to have the ability to drive themselves to the work site. They've not been able to have their license restored to them because they have outstanding traffic fines that they still need to pay. Offenders, when they're inmates, they have their licenses taken away, restored to them ordinarily at the end of their sentence. But if they have outstanding traffic fines, the license is held in suspension. So they can't pay their fines because they have no money, they have no jobs. They paid their time, but they can't pay their fines. They could do the right thing and pay their fines if they could only complete their programs and get a job in a trade, but they can't do that because they don't have a driver's license, and hence the vicious circle that they're stuck in. This bill, House Bill 2986, allows us to break that circle. Thanks to some great creative partnership between DMV, Corrections, Judiciary, and BOLI, we've worked out a straightforward, no-cost way for the court to reinstate a person's driving privileges as long as the person is enrolled in a certified pre-apprenticeship or apprenticeship program. This provides a further incentive for the student or apprentice to work hard and be successful in their program. If they leave the program, the license suspension is restored. The individual must begin making payments within 6 months of completing the program, or again, the court will reissue the suspension. Senators, passing this little bill into law will incentivize good decisions and good behavior. It'll help build our skilled workforce. It'll get more fines paid and thereby bring much needed money into our courts. It breaks down the unnecessary bureaucratic silos and barriers, and it gets individuals back on track. I urge you to support this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions about it. We also have Kimberly Daly from Judiciary, Amy Joyce from Department of Transportation, Cindy Booth from Department of Corrections here.
All right, thank you. Questions for the Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dembrough, currently, if you are suspended, you can get a conditional that would allow you to go to and from work. My question is, why in this are we doing full restoration rather than conditional?
Mm-hmm. And let me just say, we're going to bring Amy Joyce up for that, because that's a question I have. Mm-hmm. Also call a hardship license. So Amy, why don't you go ahead and come on up.
Right. That was something that we looked into in an earlier version, and there were problems with that, and that's why we landed on this solution.
Okay.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing the DMV. To answer your question, Senator Cruz, on a failure to comply suspension, which is the only type of suspension under this bill that the person could take advantage of the release of the suspension, that is only for non-payment of fines to the court on a traffic case. The law currently does not allow a hardship permit to get to work or school or anywhere else on that type of suspension. So under current law, there is not a hardship permit. In working with Representative Dembrough and representatives from the judicial branch and corrections, we explored the idea of adding a hardship for this very sort of discrete group of people, a very small group of people we think would be able to take advantage of this. What I determined in working with the experts of DMV is that the systems at DMV are set up so that a worker at DMV could not issue a hardship permit to somebody who has a failure to comply suspension. The system prevents it to help guard against human error. If the law was changed to allow a hardship permit in these very limited set of circumstances, we're estimating, I think judicials are estimating, maybe about 100 people a year could take advantage of this. DMV system, we'd have to lift that block against issuing a hardship for everyone who gets a failure to comply suspension. At any one time, there are about 180,000 people in Oregon who have a failure to comply suspension on their record. So it lifts that guard against human error that is quite important in the DMV systems with the millions of transactions we do in a year. So that's why in discussions with Representative Dembrough, after exploring that, we asked that not be the direction, because it takes away that guard that DMV has in place so that we don't make human errors.
I will follow up on this. So the court grants these where, such as we had the case where the suspension could be lifted if they paid half, and that's failure to comply. They're getting something from the court, gives them the, let's say, the paperwork they need to go to the DMV and then have that lifted, correct?
Correct.
So why couldn't we have the same process with a judge basically giving that piece of paper based on that being determined in front of the judge? He or she determines that the person is in an apprenticeship program and they check the box or whatever. I mean, I'm just, the disconnect for me is that if we are already allowing failure to comply to be unsuspended for a period of time, so long as they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, paying fines, why couldn't we extend that out without having the concern of 180,000 people potentially getting some benefit?
Chair Przanski, actually, I think that's exactly what the bill is doing. So what the court will do, or the person who's now enrolled in the apprentice program would go to the court and actually go to a clerk. There isn't going, as I understand it from the judicial branch, not some formal motion to a judge or anything like that. Go to a clerk at the court, show the documentation of the apprenticeship, get set up on a payment plan that maybe starts in 6 months, something like that. The clerk approves it, then they'll actually key into the system as they do with anybody else who they set up on a payment plan on a failure to comply. The two computer systems talk to one another, and DMV's system knows now that when this person shows up, that hold is not on the license. So now this person shows up at DMV and says, I want to get reinstated. DMV looks at the system and says, yep, that's available, just like anybody else who gets on a payment plan with the court, and they can get their license back. But it's a full-blown license, not a hardship permit. Okay. I think that's the difference.
So the hardship basically gives limitations as to how to drive and when you can drive, the route you can take. And what this is basically going to say, we're not going to have those limits so long as you're in compliance with the court, and meaning, in this case, with the program.
Chair Przanski, that's exactly right.
And Chair Przanski, if I can just add that the, BOLI will develop the form that will be given to the certified programs that can then be given to the student. The student can take to the court, and then it can be entered in the system, as Amy suggested.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Okay, let's take the same person, same conditions, suspended, failure to pay fine, and they get released, and they actually have a job.
Success.
But there are still, they're still suspended. Why? What I don't understand. We're doing this for somebody going into an apprenticeship program. But if they have a job on the outside,
it does happen. That's where someone reappears in front of the court after a failure to comply. The court usually will say, you pay this amount up front, and then we'll release your license, and you will get your license back. As long as you continue to pay under the new payment plan. And that's why we had that other bill that said that you can be suspended more than once in a 10-year period.
Right.
So the difference here is that you have someone that's going into or is in a program, and they're going to get the benefit without needing to maybe make an upfront cash payment, as compared to someone who's already been in noncompliance, and the court says, if you make these payments, and some courts will say if you make 6 payments on a monthly basis showing that you're demonstrating it, we'll let it do it. Or they'll say you owe $600 to the court, you pay $200, we'll lift it. But that's the way it is.
All right. And again, Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, the bill requires that repayment to begin within 6 months of completion of the program. So that is the goal. They get a job, they start repaying.
There's the checks and balances. All right. Anyone else who needs to testify on this one? I've got 2 other bills I want to take care of today. We'll close the public hearing, and this one's ready to go.
Yes, sir.
Open up a work session on House Bill 2986A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2986A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2986A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussions?
Mr. Chair, my questions were based on, I just want to make sure that we aren't giving somebody a leg up that isn't allowed to other people under similar circumstances. That was the whole purpose.
I know. I went back and forth, and that's why I was thinking the hardship would be way, but I understand the limitations with the hardship.
Right.
All right. Any other questions? Any other comments? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. And Senator Roblin, will you be the carrier? And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2986A. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2121A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2121A takes monitoring authority from Department of Motor Vehicles and authorizes the circuit court to determine whether a defendant satisfied treatment order of the court. It prohibits DMV from reinstating driver privileges unless the person has provided proof of completing a treatment program, the person has a court order that the person has taken sufficient steps to complete treatment, or 15 years have elapsed since the date of the person's conviction. directs court to notify DMV of restrictions or removal of restrictions, allows person to file motion with circuit court to show that the person has taken sufficient steps to complete treatment, and allows the district attorney to object.
All right, we have two individuals. Dana, why don't you come up, and it looks like Amy Joyce, you're also on this one. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on 2121A? All right. Dana, why don't you start?
Thank Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm here. I'm Dinah Vitalins, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney, and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are in support of House Bill 2121A. Essentially, as you know, in terms of DUI convictions, treatment and completion of treatment is a critical component, and we believe that it also helps treatment helps people not to reoffend, and so proof of completing treatment is critical. And so essentially, if this provides a mechanism for reinstatement of driving privileges when an individual has participated in a program that might have been out of state or maybe not otherwise qualified, it's just that extra insurance that the treatment obligations were met under the DUI statute. So we support it.
All right, thank you. Amy?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. 2121 was the result of an interim work group gathered by Representative Thompson and others to look at some DUI statutes. Back in 2011, DMV was looking at rewriting one of its rules, which required folks who had been convicted of DUI to prove that they'd completed approved alcohol or drug treatment before they could get their license reinstated, looking at doing some rules to allow for perhaps an exceptions process. At that point, the statutory authority for DMV's rule came into question. So in 2012, in the short session, the legislature passed House Bill 4011, which granted DMV that clear statutory authority and also granted an exceptions authority, and then also sunset that law to end January 1 of 2014 to allow time to look at both an exceptions process, but also fundamentally who should be that gatekeeper on proving up treatment before after a DUI conviction. So 2121, the result of that, and after amendments in the House, it comes out in this form, which is, again, DMV will be requiring proof of treatment before reinstatement of the license after a DUI conviction. It does allow exceptions, although now that authority is with the courts. So if a person, we've seen many permutations of this, a person the judge might not have ordered treatment at all, or might have ordered treatment that isn't on the Oregon Health Authority's approved list, or the person might have done treatment out of state, or the person might have not done treatment but has many years of verified sobriety, those sorts of things, which become quite problematic for DMV to be the one insisting that they do treatment. So that exceptions authority transfers now to the courts, and the bill outlines a whole procedure for that. And finally, what the bill does is there's effectively a 15-year limitation on this requirement. So if 15 years goes by, that requirement just sort of falls off the books and the person can get their license reinstated. That's what the bill does.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing, House Bill 2121A. Open up a work session, House Bill 2121A. Senator Dingfelter.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2121A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelter moves House Bill 2121A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to volunteer to carry it.
Senator Dingfelter will be the carrier. I was going to ask someone else, but quite all right. All right, so we'll go ahead and close the work session on 2121A, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 3277A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3277A amends ORS 137-106 to make clear that the prosecuting attorney must present restitution information to the court within 90 days of the time the judgment is entered. The A. Engrossen version also includes a provision that the district attorney has to give evidence to the defense attorney 10 days before the hearing.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. I'm mindful of the time, so this will be very brief. In 2011, State v. McLaughlin totally overhauled the restitution system in Oregon. If court cases could come with a fiscal, this one would have been big. Basically, while I was a prosecutor, which I was for 6 years before I took on this position, you got 90 days, if you asked for it, from the time of sentencing to help a victim get their restitution information to the court. That was the general practice all over. McLaughlin turned that from 90 days to 0 days. You needed to have it at the time of sentencing. This has had the practical effect of excluding many victims from restitution and putting district attorneys in a frantic situation, as defendants who are in custody and would like to get out of custody often are sentenced only days after they are indicted, creating an effective window of sometimes as little as a week for a victim to get their medical bills, their insurance information, other articulations of damages. It's just been a terrible burden. The Engrossed modification, as mentioned by counsel, provides an obligation on district attorneys to submit any information in their possession to the defense 10 days in advance of any hearing date on restitution. DOJ doesn't have a position on that. That's a discussion between OCDLA and ODAA. I am available for questions.
All right. Thank you. Dinah, I know you're listed. Do you want to come up and put something on the record since you've traveled this distance?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Dinah Vitalins, Crook County District Attorney, and representative of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Essentially, we support House Bill 3277, and our only request, and I've spoken with Ms. Meyer, and she essentially agrees, is that the remedy for a district attorney not providing the exhibits and witness list to a defendant 10 days prior to the hearing be a continuance of the hearing and not a bar to victims recovering restitution. And we request that because often victims will show up at hearings with, oh, I forgot this receipt or I forgot that receipt. And so we would not want to stop victims from collecting restitution, and that's our only request.
All right. So basically we're looking at a little bit more work on this before we move it out.
I think so.
All right. So with that, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony during the public hearing? Not seeing anyone come forward. Did you have questions? All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We will bring the bill back. We'll work through Mike. We'll coordinate whatever needs to be done between the parties, and then we'll get that back before us. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3277A. Thank the committee for staying a few minutes over, and we will be adjourned until tomorrow. What time?